Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
The Science of Sport podcast with sports editor Mike Finch and sports scientist Professor Ross Tucker.
So in the last couple of days, I've been binge watching a bit of a series on TV. Well, when I say TV, I talk about YouTube, and watching the Zwift Academy 2024. And it was something that I actually started watching in 2023. We know it's been going a bit longer than that, but it's an interesting event, challenge, all sorts of things, because it's based on the fact that initially it was started off as a bunch of guys who really got on Zwift, got a chance to then go to this finals, and then they would get to race with the very best in the world and get assessed. And then the guy that won that finals event would then get a pro contract and then go on to become a pro rider for a certain amount of time. And, you know, initially when you looked at it, when I looked at the first part of the competition, I thought, well, this is a great promotion for Zwift. It's a really cool idea. If you're really good on Zwift and your numbers make sense, you can suddenly transfer that to the road and become a pro rider. And it's, you know, for Zwift and anybody doing e-biking, it's a wonderful promotion. But I did kind of feel for a while it was kind of almost a bit of a gimmick in many ways. So one of the things we're going to be talking about today is we're going to be talking to the winner of the women's event at the Zwift Academy, Maddie LaRue, in a bit short time, and just talk about some of the experiences that she went through, how realistic it was, and whether the Zwift Academy really has a lot of credibility within the cycling world as a feeder event for top professionals. And we'll tackle that in a few moments' time. But before we get on to that, as usual, I got Professor Ross Tucker here with me. And I know that you've come back from a meeting in London where you talked about the state of the game?
Shape of the game.
Shape of the game. There we go.
So this is like World Rugby's biggest between the lines conference.
Yeah, this obviously is a rugby thing. Yeah.
There are other occasions where World Rugby has bigger meetings where people discuss lofty important things like money.
Yes.
But this was the one where we actually discuss rugby.
So, and who's there? I mean, yeah, so it's so, World Rugby.
Yeah, so this was the first time that World Rugby had brought together like all its different type of committees. And so what they've done is for anything rugby related, again, I always talk about between the lines, they've got committees. So there's a women's high performance committee, there's a men's high performance committee, there's a community rugby development committee, there's the referees group, there's a competitions committee, and then there's the sort of CEOs committee. And so they were all there together. And so over the course of a week, different smaller meetings were held, and then two big meetings either side were held with the whole group. And so what you end up with is representation from the community game, which usually takes the form of unions who send their community rugby managers along to represent their views. You would have the professional game represented by the international players, a group of coaches. For instance, Gregor Townsend from Scotland was there the whole time. Jock Nienaber was there for most of it. So it was some pretty good coaching kudos and brains in the room. Among the players, you would have the international rugby player, Sir Conrad Smith, a guy called Dean Mum, incredibly impressive guy, one of the most impressive people I've ever met, actually. Like, amazing. He's an actuary now, but just understands all these concepts of risk that I love to talk about with respect to injury. I've never met a player who gets it so quickly. He's incredible. He was there. And there's a few others. Then you've got the CEOs of all the major unions, you know. So Rian Oberholtz, who was there from South Africa, the Australia, England. So those are the money guys. And then who am I missing out? Women's rugby is represented from coaches and players, and then World Rugby is obviously represented from all its different people. So does that give you a sense? It's probably about 100 to 120 people at most in the room, and they discuss how the game is looking and what changes need to be considered, both for safety and the spectacle and the value and the attractiveness of the product, if you want to call it that.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like you've got all the stakeholders. Anybody that's going to shape the game now and in the future.
Yeah, I suppose there'll always be people saying, I should be in that room. But I think you could have a room of 700, 7,000, it still wouldn't be big enough for everyone. But yeah, I think it represents the views well. And so obviously player welfare is a key agenda item. And so we, myself and our chief medical officer, Dr. Aina Falvey, gave a presentation at the start on day one. And then we dip in and out. We went to the community one to talk about the lower tackle height trials. We go to the Women's High Performance Committee to talk about women's specific concussion risk and the research we're doing in that space. We were in the men's one to talk about the mouth guards, because that's obviously the big welfare initiative at the moment. And those are the players who are using them. You know, Gregor Townsend was there, head coach of Scotland. And he had literally in the days before the meeting said some things post-match about his concerns about the way the mouth guard was being used. So there was a little bit of discussion had to be held in that regard. And it would be wrong to call it like a tense conversation, but it's a very invested conversation on both sides. Because, and this is what I've realized, and I think the most interesting thing that came out of this week for me is you can go away and solve the player welfare issues for rugby on paper, on my laptop. And I can come there with all the tools in the world and I can say, this is how it's going to go. And none of it will work. Mm. Because if you don't bring the stakeholders, specifically the coaches, I think as the number one, and then the players, in other words, it's the players via the coach for me, then even the best solution in the world isn't going to work. And you realize this, I read subsequently, discussion continues about how many games players play, how much they should rest after a concussion. Is the season too long? How much off-season should there be? You can come up with a perfect calendar and you can say, this is the number of games you should play and it'll be 30% less than currently. And the players would say, jog on. Mm. Take a long walk off a short pier. We're not playing less. Why? Because playing less means earning less. It means less and doing less of what I love to do.
Mm.
The players want to play.
Mm.
So you can't. So that's not a viable solution. So then I got to thinking, you know, in the Cold War, when the East and the West were negotiating communism and the potential fall of communism, and there was this concept that was applied. As I read it, it dates back 100 years before that, called realpolitik. And it was, don't come with the best solution. Come with the only solution. you know what I mean? And the solution you find isn't necessarily going to be the best one, but it's the one you need if it's going to happen. So you rather think about what can we do as opposed to what should we do. It's the can that's important. And the can is determined by the players. Because of feasibility. Exactly. Yeah. You've got to understand the barriers and the limitations, and you've got to be a little bit prudent.
Mm.
And also, I mean, I dare say respectful. Because I see a lot of people on Twitter. There's a journalist guy called Sam Peters who just thinks he knows all the answers. The guy would be laughed out of the room if he came with those solutions in this environment. Because nothing that they say is viable, you know? And it's tremendously frustrating then to see, like, a player should have 3 weeks off after a concussion. I promise you they will just stop reporting concussions.
Yeah.
Because 3 weeks is punitive. And it's coincidental timing, because just this week, on Wednesday this week, as we're sitting here recording, one of the emerging stars of England rugby is a guy called Emmanuel Feu-Wabosa. And the Guardian reported, among other news outlets, gutted Feu-Wabosa rules himself out of Six Nations finale with concussion. And when you read it, it's not that he actually said, I'm out with concussion. What happened is he goes to the doctor reporting symptoms of concussion. And the specific symptom that they talk about here is that he goes feeling a little bit groggy. He wasn't feeling quite right. He reported symptoms and he was subsequently diagnosed as concussed. Now, couple things. The media picked up on this and made it sound like a miracle. What an unbelievable thing to do. This is culture change. 18% of concussions are picked up like this. Every sixth concussion is picked up because a player goes to a doctor after the game and tells him, Doc, I'm feeling a bit groggy. Doc, I'm light sensitive. Doc, I'm nauseous and I feel like I'm going to throw up, or I've got a headache. The doc says, let's do a little assessment. Okay, you know what, actually? You're concussed. Thanks. Let's rule you out. That happens 1 in 6 of our concussions. And that's because a lot of times a player will play the game and they'll take 20 potential contacts, tackles, ruck involvements, whatever it is, all of which cause head knocks, but none of them by themselves is large enough to cause the injury, but maybe cumulatively they are. Or sometimes they are large enough to cause injury, but the player is so full of adrenaline, it's the game situation, they just push through it, and it's only 2 hours 10 hours, 2 days after the game that they start to feel. Like, I think most listeners will appreciate that that can happen. Even a cyclist, you know, you fall, you feel fine, you get back on the bike, you finish. The next morning, you can't get out of bed. Things sometimes get worse before they get better, but they get worse after they feel fine too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So point is that Faye Wabosa is one of 18% of our concussions now moving forward. If this guy was told that he's going to miss 3 weeks, he is far less likely to go and self-report, I believe. Maybe some listener can persuade me that I'm cynical, but I promise you I'm not. So 3 weeks stand down is not that's the one example
To just explain why that is. In other words, if he decides that he's, as he has said there, he's concussed, he then is potentially given 3 weeks off. What does he stand to lose? Does he lose money?
Yes, well, possibly.
Because most of those guys have contracts that are...
But 3 weeks of playing time with his club.
Right.
3 weeks where someone else gets to play instead of him.
Okay.
Three opportunities to fall lower in the pecking order. Now, that makes it easier for a big name to report a concussion because they know they'll walk back in.
Yeah.
But A, he wants to play. Players want to play, especially when they're young and in form. Like, let me play. I want to play. Opportunity to play is the first thing. But secondly, and we know this, by the way, because we surveyed the International Rugby Players, which is the player group, surveyed the players and they asked them, why would you not report a concussion? Fear of letting my teammates down, fear of disappointing coach and family. That means stuff to these players. Fear of losing my starting place in the starting team, let me word that properly. Fear of not having my contract renewed because I'm 27, I'm only playing 40% of the games anyway. No way am I giving up the opportunity to start, look, because then I'll play 20%.
So your hunch is based on a fair amount of good report back as well.
Yeah. This is not just me saying, hey, look at me, a judge of human nature. Yeah. I'm going to guess how you feel. We know it, and we know it also because when you make the stand down period longer, the concussion reporting does go down. That's been seen in other sports, and I think we've seen it a little bit as well. We know it because in rugby league, the players literally in survey said we would not disclose a concussion because it would cause us to miss games. We know it because before we had a return to play process, far more players were undiagnosed than are now diagnosed with a, and we believe those two things are linked. The ability to identify is linked to the ability to manage the return to play. And so I genuinely believe like a 3 week stand down thing you'd still get some players. This guy potentially is a medical student. Maybe he would actually go and say, you know what? I don't mind missing three games. But for everyone like him, I promise you, there's more than one who'll say no. I will just rest up for a few days. I'll keep it from the doc. I'll tell the doc that I've got a sore calf or something, and I will just get back to training on Thursday instead. Mm. And so then you miss concussions. So the trade-off is, do you manage the concussions you know of more conservatively with 3 week stand downs at the expense of not picking them up, or would you rather pick them up and potentially manage a few of them more aggressively? That's the obvious example. Now, the reason I bring all that up is because what came out of the meeting with Gregor Townsend is a very similar concept of real politics. And now I'm starting to call it real science, like this podcast. And Gregor sat down with us and it was a forthright, honest conversation. He said to us what was said in the media. So if you want to understand his views, you can just listen to what's in the media. The coaches are saying, look, we fully support player welfare initiatives and we will back the use of these mouthguards. But we don't want to back something that's going to be excessively disruptive with no upside. And so there's a trade-off again here. Like, we could pull off for mouthguard alerts, right? So the player wears a mouthguard. If it sends an alert, we could lower that threshold and we could take 5 or 6 guys off the field every game and say, that was a big hit. You need a test. You need a test. You need a test. But then the coaches and the players would reject it. They're saying, are you pulling me off too often, unnecessarily? I'm not going to wear this mouthguard at all. So in your quest for perfect welfare management, you end up with nothing because you overreached, you know? And Gregor made, I think it was a really important point. And it wasn't just him, by the way. It was just he was the one we got a conversation with. But there were a few others making the same point as, like, We absolutely want this to work. We are invested. He said those words. He said, we want this to work. The best way for this to work is to not unnecessarily get guys off. So how can we find... And then, you see, we're open to compromise. You've got to... Again, it's about respecting the fact that Gregor Townsend is not a bad guy because he's raising this. He's not an opponent of player welfare for raising it. It's just that he's a coach with a set of incentives that isn't necessarily identical to mine. And if I don't respect that, then I'm never going to affect real change either. So the compromise that eventually was, before that it was, player gets an IMG alert, comes off the field, screened.
IMG being what? The
instrumented mouth guard.
Yeah, so this is the mouth guard. Yeah. So just to explain for those who haven't listened to our previous podcast.
Well, first of all, go back and catch up. Do your revision. So the instrumented mouth guard is a modified mouth guard. It's got a little accelerometer chip inside it, and it measures the acceleration of the head. And our use of this has been to include it as part of our spotting or observer process, where if a player experiences a head acceleration that is in the top 0.1%. So in other words, a very large head acceleration. We're saying that's so big that it's prudent for us to actually put you in front of a doctor for an assessment. And so come off the field, let's do the HI1 screen. If you pass it, you go back on. If you fail it, you stay off. And then let's do another test 2 hours after and another test 2 days after. So we know you've had a big knock. Let's have a look. That's all it is, right? It's not you're concussed. It's let's have a little look and see. We'll track you over the next 48 to 72 hours and have a look, see at exactly what's going on here. The problem was we were pulling players off the field and the players were going, there was one in the first game. The guy's like, what the heck? Why? And it turned out that there'd been a delay between the time he took the knock and the time the signal came. Now, that's not good either. You know, that's something that's got to be fixed. But okay, so he goes off the field. But the coaches are seeing this. They're saying, like, I don't want my best player, my key leadership guy to come off the field. It's a key part of the game. And we heard that. So we said, all right, maybe the way around this is to say when that alert arrives, let's send the doc onto the field instead of the player off the field. The doc can then go to him and say, Mike, are you okay? We've just had a knock. Look at me. Are you all right? Can you tell me? Maybe do one or two basic things, like one or two tests. And we know these tests are not great. But at least it's something. And it's something to put the player in front of the doctor. You know, actually, you can't hold my eyes. Like, you look a little bit dazed. You look a little bit confused and unsteady. Let's get you off. Or you look great. Cool. Carry on. But then at half time, we're going to do the test. Or at full time, we're going to do the test. So the test was still being done. It was just a matter of finding a compromise and saying, you know what, actually, we don't necessarily have to get you off right then and there. Let's not disrupt the game if we don't have to, but we're still going to test. So that was a compromise position. Yeah, does that make sense?
Yeah.
And no, it's not perfect. We'd love to do the test at the very moment it happened. But at the moment, certain tech issues and certain pragmatic issues don't allow that to happen. So we find a compromise. If we dug our heels in and been obstinate, we'd have no mouth guards. They'd say no. So you have to sort of... Yeah. Anyway, that's what I learned again at this meeting is don't barge your way in there and act like the smartest oak in the room and just piss everyone off to the point that they then chuck you out the window.
Because essentially you've got to sell the long-term benefits of doing this responsibly. In other words, you've got to convince people in that room that this is about responsible handling of the game so that the long-term wealth of the player is looked after.
Yeah.
You're not there to curtail or make everybody's life a misery. You're there actually to help players.
Exactly.
I guess that's what you have to sell.
And then now let's think about the doctor, right? Because that's the guy or the woman who's going to have to do these tests. Imagine you said from now on, after every game, you'd have 6 assessments to do. The doctor's eyes roll back in their heads and they go, oh, these idiots. And you know what they'd start doing is they'd rush those assessments. They wouldn't have confidence in the fact that they're doing what's a real assessment. They'd see it as an obligation and not an opportunity to find a concussion. And you would undermine your own tool by asking for too much. And so you have to say, let's just be realistic here. And we can work towards something maybe a little bit better. It's the same as the HIA, by the way. When that was introduced, and this was before my time, it was a 5-minute pitch side test. It's now a 12-minute off the pitch in the stadium in a quiet room test because you've got to bring people with you on the journey that you're trying to change. And if you go in straight away and you ask for too much, they will just run away and they will say, no, You are actually just a net negative. You're interfering. Mm. We get that there's an upside, but you're bringing so much downside you can jog on.
Yeah.
And so that was what I learned. And then it's just funny that this Werbosi thing comes out. And I was listening, actually driving over here now, to a podcast saying, shows you how good England's doctors are. It's got nothing to do with England's doctors. This is legit. One of the main sources of how concussion is identified is player honesty and reporting. Same with the mouth guards. People came at World Rugby hard when they made that change from saying, we're no longer going to remove the player at the time. They say, oh, look at World Rugby bowing to the demands of the players. It's not bowing to the demands of the players. It's respecting that actually the bloke who's on the field is the one who matters more than you and me.
Mm.
He or she's the one risking the concussion. So no, I'm not willing to just ignore them. Not willing to only listen to them, but I'm also not willing to ignore them. And that's real politics, real science.
So, I mean, besides that, are there other... I can imagine these other things that are discussed at a meeting, are they? I mean, are radical rule changes made? I mean, are they going to make the polls wider? Or, you
know? It's going to be 10 points for a try. And,
10 points and for... Well, for that's one of the elements. I always think you should have more points for a try and less to do with the conversion.
I mean, it used to be like that, right?
It used to be 7 points for a try, didn't it?
It used to be 4 and 2, so 6 for a converted try.
Yes.
And they changed it to... Yeah.
And that's are there any radical ideas? Does somebody put a hand up and say, I think we should make tries 7 points?
No, and just the bit I said earlier was a joke, by the way, the thing about the 10. There are some rule changes, and there's also a lot of groups that have been formed because the sport's so complex. So there'll be conversations around different elements of the game, the set pieces, the ruck, the tackle. There are some things that'll be trialed. They'll all be discussed and voted on in May, so I can't really talk about specifics because, A, I don't actually know how those votes will go. But there are some things that will certainly be looked at in the future.
Mm. Is that to do with how the game is an entertainment spectacle, or is
yes
it? Okay,
exactly, right. And you know, it's interesting, for every time you go to one of these, there's always this tension between safety and spectacle. Most of the time you can navigate that tension without compromising one side or the other, but sometimes you can't.
Well, they are quite conflicting in many
ways,
aren't they?
They can be, yeah. And you know, and I make this point a lot, like we get these critics again saying that we haven't managed to budge concussion rates. Concussion rates have stayed the same over the last 15 years, which is true largely. But then look at the game, how that's changed over 15 years. The speed of the game, the number of tackles in a game, the ball in play time is longer, which means there's less rest and recovery time than there used to be. There are more tackles now that involve two or three tacklers than there used to be. So now you're carrying the ball and I'm tackling you, and John and Simon are both going to come in at the same time. Used to be 1-on-1. Now it's often 3-4-on-1. So that's 5 heads at risk. It used to be 2. So I'm looking at this and saying, the fact that the concussion rates are staying the same is actually a win, because a lot of things about the game are moving us in a direction where there will be more head impacts and potentially more injuries. And so, but that's really hard because it's nuanced and it's complex. And so, but it's an area where we're trying to quantify concussions per 1,000 tackles. And that's dropped. And concussions per 1,000 rucks has dropped a lot in the last 2 years compared to before. Whether that's a... I'd like to see 3-4 years of change before...
And I think that's as a result of these of small... Like the tackle height.
We hope that, so. And for sure, the red card that now is given to a player who runs into a ruck recklessly and hits a head, because that's such a discrete event. And it involves a decision to run for 4 meters into a relatively static situation. I think we've changed behavior there quite significantly. And so the risk of a head injury from that situation is now down by about 50%. It's been cut in half.
Well, that's a result in its own, isn't it?
The tackle is a little bit more difficult because it's such a fluid, dynamic event. It's not like a player decides to run in and hit someone static. It's a moving player. I'm moving. We're both moving. Other players are moving around us. It's very difficult. So, yeah, unsurprisingly, we're not seeing as much there. But we have seen smaller shifts down. But again, I would like to see 3 years of consecutive change before I'm saying, or it must stabilize at a new low level. Then I'll be more persuaded of it. But the things are happening there, you know. But now it's the conversation is around ball in play. And there's been a lot of chat in social media about this lately, is we need more ball in play. So we need less time lost when there's static non-rugby playing moments. For instance, a scrum is given and it takes 45 seconds to get the players together. A line out is given, it takes 36 seconds before the ball comes back in. How do we make that less? less, you know. There's also talk about substitutes. That came up on the weekend, Monday. Fewer subs will make players more tired, and that'll open the game up, and they'll get smaller, and it'll be more entertaining and so on. And I'm sitting in the audience always with my welfare hat going, oof, this may not work out well, no, guys. It's
more likely to be injuries.
Because we know that fatigue is a risk factor for injuries. We also know that fatigue is a risk factor for crappy rugby.
Yeah.
Tired players don't play good rugby.
Yeah, they fumble.
And,
yeah.
And it's really interesting. I was sitting with Conrad Smith, who's the players guy now, IRP, the former New Zealand centre, and the aforementioned Dean Mum.
Yeah, we've actually interviewed him on the podcast.
That's right,
yeah.
Exactly. And you know, Dean was saying, so, and I was talking to them about attack versus defence and the imbalance between them. And they said, you know, the thing in rugby league is defending is really hard physically. It's much more fatiguing than rugby union. But in rugby union, they both reckon it's the other way around. Attacking is more fatiguing than defending because you've got to run patterns off the ball. You've got to shift into space. You've got to cover your own ball on the ground by putting four guys in there, which means you've got fewer players on their feet to cover bigger space. The defending team just has to line up and rush. Mm. So then I get to thinking now with my pacing strategy hat on is if you load the game with fatigue and you know that attack is more fatiguing than defense, then what will more fatigue compromise more, attack or defense? It's going to compromise attack. Because that's the thing that's fatiguing. And so if you make players more and more and more fatigued, I think you make defending relatively easier than attacking, and you end up with a more defensive game.
Mm. It's a bit like boxers in the 12th round of a title fight.
No one wants to throw a punch.
Well, nobody can throw an effective punch.
Yes. Yeah. And if you tried and you opened yourself up, maybe you'd be walloped. Mm. And so that's actually a really good analogy.
Mm.
It's the same as in football. Like, extra time is often rubbish.
Yeah.
And it's in part psychological because the risks are getting larger and larger of a mistake. But I think it's also in part physiological. Tennis, the fifth set of a tennis match is often really poor quality.
Mm.
So I have some welfare and performance unease about some of the conversations around, let's have fewer subs, let's have more fatigue. I don't know that it'll actually achieve what it's intended to. And I think it might achieve certain things that it doesn't want to, which is more injuries. Imagine four subs on the bench or five, and now you've got a winger or someone who's got a slight hamstring niggle in the 65th minute. The guy's going to go for 20 more minutes.
Yeah.
Instead of missing 1 week, he's missing six.
Yeah.
That's not in anyone's best interests for that to happen. So I do have some concerns, but we'll see. It's really interesting, as always, in rugby. Like, so many things have to still be discussed and yeah.
So this, I mean, what you went through is essentially a discussion. Then what comes from that? A proposal and then obviously vote.
A set of recommendations, and that's some of those are in May. So again, I don't know what the outcome of those will be. And then a set of questions that need to be addressed. And to do that, they set up specific working groups. So for instance, there might be, I don't know this for sure, but there might be a group to look at the scrum specifically. How do we have fewer collapsed scrums? How do we speed the scrum up without compromising its safety? The line out, the ruck, the tackle, the subs, and so on. There might be specific projects that now have to be initiated so that, because again, I know I'm biased, but the sport is genuinely committed to being led by evidence and expertise, and not, you know, people make an unfair accusation, I are just a bunch of blokes in suits making decisions. It's actually far from that. Like, the caliber of people who go onto those working groups is really, really good coaches and players.
It's players and
and they'll make those decisions. So the meeting effectively is the first word. And then out of that comes a whole bunch of next things, and we'll see what those are in future. Yeah, but for me, the general theme is that real politics / real science thing that I was just reminded of. And then these, I wouldn't say concerns, because I think it is fascinating. Like, does rugby change for the better if there's more fatigue?
Mm.
But I think it's a nervy one.
So if you're a rugby fan, I mean, when can you expect to hear about some of the proposals, or do you only hear about proposals that become successful? In other words, if somebody says, let's make the polls wider, does it get to a point where the average person who loves rugby gets to know about Eddie Jones, who proposed this from New Zealand? Or do you just kind of have to wait until the final proposal is okayed by World Rugby and then it's implemented?
No, they're pretty good about letting people know what's coming up. So the meeting in which all this will be voted on is May. And so in the lead up to that, it will be known what the considerations are. And then afterwards, the results will be known. So you will know that they've made the poles wider. There are now four poles like an AFL. You'll know it because it's announced. And some of it will be more sensational and newsworthy than others. I mean, a lot of the stuff is not headline grabbing, but some of it might be, and we'll all get to. We'll probably have a. I suspect we might.
I like that clickbait idea. You see, I'm always looking for the story as a journalist.
I suspect that there will be a conversation for us in May again around the real politic and the real sciences. Like on the player welfare side, like how much do you ask for and how much is the game willing to give? I think there'll be one or two changes that come up there and we can revisit them at the time.
Stay tuned for more.
Right, so on to the subject that I touched on at the beginning of our podcast today. And for those of you that might have watched the YouTube, four episodes. Of the Zwift Academy. And there's been a few years where they've been doing these shows, and it's been quite interesting because, as I mentioned at the start, there's been some amazing athletes that have come out of the Zwift Academy. And the basis of it was always that bunch of riders who went on to the sort of esports of Zwift would then be chosen based on their Zwift performance, their Zwift performances, and then they would be put into these camps in real world cycling, and they would compete, and eventually the winner would get a professional contract. And the two teams that were involved in terms of the professional contract in the women's side, it was the Canyon SRAM Generation Development Squad, and on the men's side it was the Alpecin de Kuenig Development Team as well. So two big name teams, and whoever wins these Zwift Academies then goes into this professional setup. So it's an amazing thing, because a lot of athletes that haven't come through the traditional system suddenly get a chance via this program to suddenly get the experience of being in a professional team and getting the chance to compete against and with and train and all those sort of things with the best in the world. So it's a real opportunity. So we managed to get hold of the winner of the women's event this year, Maddie LaRue, who is a 27-year-old from Bloemfontein here in South Africa. And she was fascinating because if you watch the series, you see she's really quite animated and quite fun to listen to. And she seems like a really relaxed individual. But her story is really one of incredible determination, because she's been pushed back a few times. She's managed to get back up. She's been told that she doesn't have it, but she gets back on the bike and she's out there doing the best. And now she's got an opportunity to kind of live her dream to some extent.
Yeah, and she said, what were her words? No one will ever outwork her, I think was her quote. So, which is commendable. And I reckon one of those athletes then, that what you really need the coach for is to say what not to do and how and when to stop, you know? So that'll be real, real interesting. We said to her at the end of this interview, we'll see her come on at the end of the season and share some insights into her first full pro season. But just on the Zwift thing,
There has been discussion on Discourse, on our Discourse channel. And for those of you who haven't mentioned it in this podcast so far, if you are wanting to get involved in our sort of almost daily discussions, you can become a member of our Patreon community, where you can go onto patreon.com and look for Science of Sport Podcast. Once you are a Patreon member, for a very small donation each month, you then get access to our Discourse channel, which is really opening up to be an amazing little community of very enthusiastic people involved in the area of sports science. And, you know, people are really kind of getting involved in lots of discussions. So one of the discussions was the Zwift Academy.
Yeah, there's a Zwift category discussion, which I think Gerald or Gareth started. Let me have a look here. Gerald, in fact, started it up. And then Gareth and myself and a few others commented. So after you've listened to this interview, you can go there. Mm. What I was going to say is we should probably have prefaced the show and say that it's full of spoilers. If you're listening to this, then you'll know who won and
but
who
the
didn't.
But the process of the winner is great. I'm always getting phone calls.
Mike's always in demand from...
Always defined, yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's my wife, you see. But I've got one of those phones that the only person that rings is my wife when she phones me. So this is a message her.
While you do that, just some thoughts on the Zwift Academy in general. It's kind of like the idols of cycling, right? Except cycling is interesting because such a large part of cycling performance can be predicted by numbers. You can measure it, and then those measurements make predictions. And so now you've got this Zwift, this virtual world where you can have cyclists from all over the world, even a small town like Bloemfontein in South Africa, who can suddenly put themselves on the map to the extent that a cycling director in England or where Spain, if it was Magnus Baxter, whoever it is, and says, hang on.
He's the guy that runs the Zwift Academy for Canyon SRAM.
Yeah, he runs Canyon SRAM.
Yes, he runs Canyon
SRAM. So therefore he's in the series. You'll see him there. His daughter's one of their star riders.
Yeah.
He's saying, hang on, that's a pretty impressive 5-minute power output. Maybe we want to keep an eye on this person. Now, you've got to make sure you're looking at someone who's honest about their weight, because if you've ever been on Zwift, you've been overtaken by someone doing 17 watts a kilo for an hour because they've either forgotten to put a zero at the end of their mass or they deliberately lied. But the point is that Zwift now is a filter that allows you to, like, basically, let's say, take the top 1% of all physiological capacities as assessed by power output. Then let's see what they're like in real life. And that's what you watch when you watch the YouTube show. It's real interesting because, again, you've already had enough spoilers, so what's one more? The men's race is not won by the guy with the best power. And he's actually upset about it when they tell him. He calls it a stupid decision. He almost, which ironically confirms their choice to not take him. Mm. Because he's not taken for reasons other than his physiology. And one of them is his hot-headedness. Mm. And he almost loses it with the two directors of Alpecin. And the one's that guy who looks like he should be in a shampoo ad, which is appropriate for Alpecin. And no, German.
Oh, the German, okay.
And then their coach, who's also quite an... I'll tell you this funny one about that guy now in a moment. My impression anyway. Yeah, so the winner isn't the guy with the biggest numbers, you know, because they do all these really interesting tests. They do 20 seconds, 3 minutes, 6 minutes, 12. They do lactate threshold testing. They do some matched up sprints against the pros from the Alpecin team or the Canyon SRAM team in the case of the woman. And so they've got numbers. And I will say, this season compared to last, they show those numbers more often. So it's quite cool for a nerd like me. They'll show you at the end of Maddie's hill climb what her wattage was. They'll show you Matteo and Anton and Louis' numbers in their 12-minute test on the last day compared to the first day. And
they give watts per kilo, not necessarily power, do they?
Yeah, but then even while they're riding, you'll see it in the fourth episode, as they're going up the climb, they've got what might be a retrofitted nonsensical number, but it's like a little computer display on the screen showing 434, 467, 510 watts. And then next thing you know, you see the guy lying on the side of the road in a heap of exhaustion. And so it's quite cool from that perspective. You get a little bit more insight. Another thing listeners of this podcast will recognize is they talk a lot about durability. Last season, not one mention of it. This season, like, most of their requirement for picking these cyclists was, can they do it when they're tired? Mm. And so that's the durability concept. And so 2 or 3 of the tests that they do are aimed at trying to assess the durability of the cyclist. And I found that interesting because what it does is it shows a trend towards that becoming one of the most important metrics in cycling. Is, yeah, okay, fine, you can do 7 watts a kilo for X minutes. Let's see how you do it after 4 hours of cycling. Mm-hmm. So that was pretty interesting. And then you might recall last season, you put me onto Zwift Academy last season. Mm. And I remember laughing at the Alpecin sporting, the coach, basically, the high performance guy. I think his name's Christoph. Because by the end of it, it looked like he'd been given a choice of 3 turds. He looked utterly, utterly unimpressed by all. I think back then it was 4 finalists, but they got rid of 1 early. This year, he was excited from the start. I think they got a better caliber of cyclist this time. The guys were really strong. I mean, some of the numbers were eye-wateringly good. Not Pogačar, Vingegaard, but then who is, right? Mm. But they were good. And the other thing is they were matched. I remember last year they had a climber, they had a sprinter, and they had a puncher. And then no matter what the test was, one of them was always great, one of them was okay, and one of them was blown off the back. This year, I think they got 3 climbers and 3 fairly good, maybe not all climbers, but good enough. So I think this season was probably the best one that I've seen. And yeah, it comes down to really hard choices in both the men and women. So yeah, I would highly encourage. We'll put all 4 episode links up in the show notes and you can have a look. And then, of course, you can now hear from the last woman standing.
Yeah.
herself.
Well, what I loved about this interview is that she is obviously a very effervescent and clearly somebody that really enjoys her cycling. I mean, she does a huge amount of riding each week and obviously very dedicated to the sport. And you kind of finish the interview really hoping that she achieves everything she wants to achieve. And you'll hear about some of her goals in this interview. But here is Maddie LaRue. So Maddie, welcome to the show and congratulations for winning the Zwift Academy. I mean, it's become quite a big talking point in the world of cycling because I think it's what, third or fourth year, isn't it, that Zwift Academy's been going?
Well, for the woman, I think it's the eighth maybe.
Is it the eighth? Is me? Is that? Okay. All right. Because I think the most famous of all the Zwift Academy people is obviously Jay Vine, who's racing at the pro level now and has really made that transition from being like a Zwifter, which is kind of what their promotion is, to somebody who's made the elite level. But tell us really briefly, I mean, we've had this debate over the last couple of days. My belief when I looked at the Zwift Academy was that they were looking at a Zwift race. They'd say, right, we want to make sure the three best riders on Zwift, and then we're going to take them to this academy because their numbers all make sense, and we're going to see if they can ride on the road. Was it as simple as that?
No, I think if it was as simple as that, then I maybe wouldn't have gone, because I believe that there are riders on Zwift that have better numbers than I do. But cycling is not just, or let's say in real life, cycling in Europe is not just a numbers game. It's all about fitting into a team and race dynamics in real life, bike handling skills and all these nitty gritty things that you don't get to see on Zwift. So
give us a bit of background to you then. I mean, what you've been up to. I mean, for us in South Africa, if anybody said Madeleine LaRue, nobody would probably know who you are. But actually, you've been bubbling under in Europe for a few years now, and you're right up there, but you're not necessarily in the sort of zeitgeist of South African cycling, which is where we should know you.
Yeah, so I've only, let's say this is my fourth year in cycling, and I've done cycling for 3 years now. This is my fourth year, and out of the 3 years, I've been in Europe for two of them. So it was only 1 year long stint in South Africa on the South African cycling scene. But I originally come from triathlon for more than 10 years. So I still feel like an outsider in the South African cycling scene. It's like, I don't really feel like people really know who I am. But I mean, I don't need people to know who I am. It's not why I do bike racing. I like riding my bike, so that's why I do it. I did triathlon and everything. And then during the COVID lockdown, obviously it was quite hard to keep training for triathlon, although don't get me wrong, just because it was hard didn't mean I didn't try. But I broke a treadmill within 2 weeks of training, and swimming was kind of like not really happening. And during that time I got onto Zwift, and I suppose it's kind of like the story has run full circle now. Zwift, where I started thinking about changing from triathlon to cycling, and now Zwift giving me this opportunity to actually continue my development in professional cycling in Europe. I was in, after lockdown, Cycle Nation, Sandton City Cycle Nation found me on Strava, and then I raced for them for a year. But then at the end of, I think it was 2021, I just finished my teaching degree here at the COFSIS. And I was kind of like at a crossroads. I want to continue the sport, but I don't really know how to get into Europe, but I also have to look at the reality of things, and like I need to find a job. So I was kind of like applying to teaching positions, but then also trying to figure out a way into Europe. And that's where Joanna van der Winkel from the Cycle Nation team, she got to talking with Ashley Moorman-Pascio, and then somehow, boom, bada bing, I ended up at the World Cycling Center, and that's where I was now for the last 2 years. But then end of last year in October, I came back home to South Africa, didn't have a contract for for this next year, didn't really have a way back to Europe. So I, Zwift Academy was literally just one of the many doors I knocked on to try and find a way back, not really thinking it would open, but yeah, here we are.
So when you were at the World Cycling Academy, what was the sort of story there? In other words, were you paid to live and train and be coached?
So we didn't really get paid. Like, we got, I would say, my dad would say, a monthly stipend. But technically, we had no expenses. They gave us, we stayed in this kind of like a hostel. So they gave us 3 meals a day. Everything was covered, medical expenses, travel costs to and from races, travel costs to and from South Africa to Switzerland. And they had the coach / sports director was there at the center, all the bikes, everything they gave us. So we had nothing that we needed money for, essentially. So that was just, yeah, I suppose, the right blessing at the right time that I found a place there. Because if I had to go to another team where, let's put it like this, I was supposed to go to a French club team this year and everything would have been self-funded. And if I had to do that 2 years ago, it would not have been possible. So that's kind of where the World Cycling Center was like a thank you.
Yeah. And the World Cycling Center was, I mean, that was it's UCI. So the purpose of that is what? To get you to a level where you then get picked up by a professional team at some point?
Yeah, so the focus point of the World Cycling Center, before they had just a men's team, but then with the development of female cycling and men's cycling being already like, it's already up there, they wanted to help develop the women's side. So they started a women's team, I think, a couple of years ago. It's not so long ago. So the whole goal, aim of this team is to help us gain racing experience and develop as riders so that essentially through a year or two, we could move into a bigger team or other continental teams. And they specifically focus on riders from countries or federation, yeah, countries where the federation isn't able to support them as well. Like, let's say, for example, countries like Australia or Great Britain, when they go to Worlds, everything is paid for them. Whereas us from South Africa, everything is self-funded. I mean, we even have to buy our own kit. Well, that has changed now in the last, what, year, 2 years, they have tried to support us better, which is a great improvement, and it's just continually getting better. So it's not to say that they're bad, like, please don't get me wrong. It's just to say that the UCI focuses more than on riders from, we would say, developing countries where the support isn't so good.
So just when you go to that academy, obviously you're not part of what's a team, right? And they're giving you access to races and competition. Do they also provide the other kind of team support, like nutrition and coaching advice, or is it very much each person's up to their own devices as far as preparation goes?
It very much depends on the coach or slash, like, the coach and the sports director is the same person. So okay. It very much depends on who this person is. So the 2 years I was there, we had each year a different coach. So the first year, the coach, she's now with the UAE ADQ, the women's team from UAE. She was very much focused on the basic bike handling skills. So we would have skills training separate from actual training and stuff. But the nutrition side of things, obviously, they'd make sure we eat enough and eat right, but essentially most of that was up to ourselves. And then last year, the other coach, she's still there. She, at the beginning of the year, she was very focused on the nutrition on the bike. So in training peaks, we had to say, okay, this is what we ate during the session, what we drank. And then essentially she would check on it and see if we're doing the right thing or not. So, but it depends from coach to coach, I think, that we're is at the center.
So then at those races, you're obviously trying to compete to get into the shop window so that some of the pro teams say, listen, we've noticed you've shown abilities at XYZ. We'd like to invite you to camps. Is that how it works? Or is it purely on the basis of your results that someone would or would not come to you and say, listen, we'd like to consider 3 months with you next year to see if you can kick on and actually make it into a full-time setup?
To be honest, I don't really know. Like, I feel like the World Cycling Center's team is quite different than, obviously it is a continental team, but I feel like it operates different than other continental teams in that they are more focused on racing as a team, as a structure, as a unit together to get a result. Whereas my experience at the World Cycling Center was that whilst at some moments we tried to race together as a team for one specific result, it was more like, okay, let's see, do your best today and just learn as much as you can, focus on yourself, get the result you want to get, which I can understand because we're all trying to get on, to be seen by other teams and to get onto another team, but it did make the racing setup a little bit hard. And it was hard to get the real good results because cycling essentially is a team sport and you need the support from your teammates to help deliver those results. So if you're essentially racing mano a mano, it's not really going to work so well. So, and then, yeah, I got the feeling that in my attempts of trying to move in to contact other teams last year, the fact that we are from the UCI did help in that they do look at you, but I don't want to say bad things, but I think it depends on who is at the center and who gives the feedback to the teams regarding this rider. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, because you're basically relying on someone to sell you.
To sell your
capabilities, to market you, to say, listen, I've got someone here who I think is going to be a great fit for you. You actually needed an agent more than you needed a coach. And it sounds like they don't have that in place because they're just there to say, you're in the window now, and I do your thing, perform.
Yeah, that's kind of one thing that those of us that have moved out of the team now, end of last year, were saying that it's all great and well that they give us these opportunities at the World Cycling Center, but we would like to see that they help us make the step to what's after World Cycling Center, because essentially that is what the team is about, but there wasn't real guidance in terms of that. I mean, I helped some of my teammates make up their cycling CVs to send out to other teams, and I don't really think that's not really my job, but that's the teacher in me, and I help as much as I can out of the little bit that I know. But yeah, so that is kind of something we asked them to maybe look at, but yeah, don't know if that's gonna.
I mean, is it fair to say then that it's a? I mean, I know that you don't want to bad mouth something that obviously had some good with you, but it's fair to say that it's disappointing that at the end of that time at the World Cycling Center you weren't in a position where you could kick on to become a pro team, because essentially you've had to find other avenues to get there, which is what we'll get to.
And also, like, I'm not going to point any fingers, but I came home actually earlier end of last year from the World Cycling Center. I still had 2 races in Europe left, but I had a certain discussion with someone, and it wasn't so great. And I was basically told that, sorry, but we don't think you have what it takes to make it in the sport. Maybe you should think about going back to triathlon or just doing Zwift racing or doing something else. And I was like, okay, well, thank you for your encouragement and your trust in my abilities, but I think it's time to go home now. Thank you very much.
It's interesting though, because if I was to design that, and you know, I love a bit of talent ID and development stuff.
Yeah, but like, Ross is very involved in talent ID, particularly at the running level.
The whole point of it would be, how do we get everyone to effectively graduate ready for the next thing? Like if I'm a school, I'm trying to prepare people to be university ready. If I'm in a university program, I'm trying to prepare them for employment readiness. This academy seems to get everyone to start the degree and never finish it. Like at the very least, they should have a standardized reporting form for the physiological things they measure in their cyclists and a results thing that you can call your CV. You know what I mean? Mm. Seems like even that was missing. So that's interesting, because I can appreciate that there would be subjective assessments of cyclists to say, you know, you just don't have it, or you do. But cycling is a sport where you can really benchmark quite well. You can say at the moment you are at this level, to make it at the next stage and then to move into the world tour, you need to go X and then Y above that level. You know?
Is that based just on numbers?
Numbers, but also now you've seen them in the appropriate environment, right? Yeah. This is not Zwift numbers anymore. This is actually race numbers. This is road numbers. This is being able to see, like, can you tactically manage yourself? Can you train? Can you? How's your discipline in the
team environment? Can you use those numbers in a race situation?
Yeah, exactly. So they've actually created the perfect environment to measure valid physiological performance numbers, as opposed to Zwift, which is partially valid, suggestive, not valid. And so, but then they don't seem to, anyway, it doesn't seem to kick on. But maybe this is, if 1 in 10 makes it, it's probably good.
Well, what's interesting is that you had this discussion with this particular person who said you're not going to make it. On what basis were they making that judgment? Or were they saying you're not going to make it because you don't have the watts per kilo, or you don't have the temperament? Or what is it?
I'm not a very aggressive person by nature. But I was told that I've been given all the opportunities I was going to get, and I haven't shown enough improvement. So it doesn't warrant that I be invited back another year, because essentially we were told that we could stay a maximum of 3 years on this team. So when I was struggling to find a team that would take me, I asked, what's the possibility to come back another year? Because if I go home now without anything for next year, it's probably that's me done. I have to look reality in the face and find a real, in quotes, a real job. if I spoke to the coach that I had the first year at the center, who was not the one at UAE, and other people that have known me during the 2 years there, they would say I've improved so much. Even my teammates that were there with me during that time is like, I'm a different Maddie last year than I was in 2021. But obviously this person didn't think so. And ultimately they have the final call. So.
And what your understanding was that they were saying you weren't aggressive enough as a rider.
My skills weren't up to par. Like, my numbers are here, but my skills were here. But okay. I am working like, trust me when I say this, I hate to be outworked. So I will work my ass off to improve the things that I am not good at. And I mean, that's my descending. The first year I got there, I was completely like, you didn't want to see me going downhill. Like, it was like, cover your eyes. That's how bad I was. But I would go onto this one climb, like, day after day, up and down and up and down and up and down. And last year I had some of my teammates, like, on rides, they would go with me and they'd let me follow their wheels down just to help me see the right lines around the corners and stuff. So I was really, really working hard on that skill that I was not so good at. And in the descending assessment of Zwift Academy, I was very, very pleased to hear that they were impressed enough. So, I mean, it's all good and well you can say that those things are not up to par and that according to you, I don't have what it takes based on this. But also take into consideration, I've only been in cycling for 3 years and I come from South African racing. It's like comparing fruits and vegetables with each other. South African racing is nothing compared to European racing. So it takes some time to learn that skill. Whereas riders from Europe, they grew up with this. So
especially Bloemfontein, right? That's where you would have done a lot of your, I mean, like in Bloemfontein, like an overpass on a hill is considered, on a highway is considered a hill, no?
Yeah, longest hill, 2 minutes. It's really frustrating.
There's actually a climb in the middle of Bloemfontein, isn't it? There's that, what's it called? The climb,
there's Naval
the
Hill. There's Naval Hill. But it's 2 minutes,
isn't it?
If I do my VO2 efforts, it's 2 minutes max. If I do 3 minutes on there, maybe the last minute it starts going flat and slightly downhill.
So, I mean, this is a good segue now to turn into talk about the whole experience of going through Zwifter Canopy, because I think it gives people really a lot of background. And you mentioned very briefly, and I'll touch on this because it kind of continues the conversation, in their assessment of your downhill, I remember watching the show and they said Maddie was very relaxed and looked very good on the downhills. In fact, you definitely weren't the worst of the three girls. In fact, you were right there as the top two. So those skills that you learned, I'm interested to know what the difference is from the person that used to be what you assess as a bad descender to somebody seems to be a good descender. And when they're assessing you in that situation, do you feel that your skills are up at a level where you could now, as you have now become part of the Canyon SRAM professional setup, that your skills are good enough to race at the very top level now?
I know I have improved a lot and my skills overall have improved a lot, but they're not done improving and there's always something that can be better. I have raced a couple of World Tour races before, and it's not like I wouldn't come. I don't think I would win those races, but the skills, let's say the little tool bag of skills I have at the moment, I don't think it's going to make me look absolutely ridiculous. So I'd be able to handle myself. But I think the fact that I'm going to the generation team or the continental team of the Canyon setup makes it just a little bit better for me to keep working on those skills to be able to perform on the World Tour level, hopefully soon.
Can I just clarify for the listeners, by whom I mean myself? When you talk about skills, like I think most people, like the obvious one is, can I go downhill fast enough to stay on wheels? But actually, like I would have thought based on my own cycling experience that there's actually that would be the first one I would solve. The other skills that I reckon would be more difficult would be like positioning within the bunch, understanding like the movements of a peloton, like being able to like interact between the team car and the peloton, communication while on the bike, stuff like that. Like, so when you talk about skills, Maddie, are you talking about that stuff or are we actually still just talking about descending?
No, I'm talking about everything. I mean, descending isn't so scary for me at the moment. As they said, I looked relaxed because I was relaxed now. I know I've worked hard on it and it doesn't frighten me anymore. But when we speak about the peloton riding skill, that is something that's still like a little bit like, oh my goodness, please don't crash. It's like the best way I can explain it, riding in a European bunch is like a washing machine effect. If you're not paying attention, you get spat out the back. It's like it goes like this all the time and you have no personal space. Everyone is touching everyone. Everyone is pushing on everyone. And it's something that you can only, I feel like, learn to handle through racing experience. I mean, because again, like in South Africa, our bunches, it's big if there are 20 girls at the starting line. Whereas in Europe, a race wouldn't even start if there are only 20 riders. So
that skill of sitting in the bunch, I mean, is that one area that you have struggled with? Or I mean, where do you assess your skill in that space?
I am not at the bottom anymore, but I'm also not at the very top. I'm maybe somewhere in the middle. I'm still really much working on it. It takes a lot of concentration for me to actually be able to not sit at the back. Like, look, I have a lot of power, and with that, I can still stay in the peloton, yo-yoing off the back, but I waste a lot of energy, and you're not, let's be honest, you're not going to win any races from the back position. So I've, in these last 2 years of the World Cycling Center, it's really been a lot about learning from my teammates how to position better in the peloton and not be so absolutely terrified that you are not moving up. At the moment, for me, it's easier to move up on the sides of the peloton Then in the middle, then I start to freak out a little bit and get too much in my head. But yeah, that's something I'm still working on. And I wouldn't say I'm great at it, but I'm also not absolutely terrible anymore.
So, I mean, if you were going to give us three insights into what people have told you about improving that, what would you say are the three things that you can learn to practice that? I mean, you say that obviously you don't want to go around the outside as much as you'd like to go down the middle, because you'll save a lot more energy if you're in the middle of the bunch. So how do you practice something like that? How do you get better than, other than just riding races, I suppose?
Yeah. It's not really something you can practice that much in training unless you're in a really big group. But also if you're just like one or two riders and a training ride, I think get comfortable riding very close to each other, almost leaning on each other at times. Sure. But then in races, it's a lot about focusing on not overthinking, overanalyzing everything, and just if once you see a gap, don't hesitate, move. Because if you start thinking about it, that gap's going to close. I suppose it also comes a lot with confidence. You have to trust yourself to know what you're doing. And obviously, what everyone keeps telling me, that nobody in the peloton wants to crash. So if you're going to push your way through, they're going to make space for you because they also don't want to crash. So it just comes with practice, and you have to have that certain confidence when you're riding in the bunch. But yeah, I think it all comes with racing experience.
And I guess it requires a fair amount of courage just to trust and to understand that you've got to almost know that you almost accept that you're going to fall, because at the end of the day, you've got to be in position. Otherwise, you're not racing anymore.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's also one thing growing to this new team now. There are riders on this team that are maybe more experienced and have better riding in a bunch skills, let's say it like this. So they could potentially help navigate me through the bunch, because you see it in some of the races as well, that there are a lot of other riders on the teams that don't necessarily know or have the confidence to move through the peloton, but they have, let's put it in layman's terms, an assigned buddy that guides them through. So, and that's also how you learn. My train of thought, but yeah.
No, you're making a lot of sense. So let's talk a little bit about the experience of the Zwift Academy. So that we obviously, and for those of you that want to watch it, it's all on YouTube. It's a very well done production. But it's kind of one of those things where you think, is this just all made for TV, and how realistic is it for the athletes? So when you see all these challenges that you have to do, I mean, you're almost doing two challenges a day. First of all, how long is that actual, as the academy itself, that finals?
So we were there for a week, or they flew me out a day earlier than the other two finalists, because I obviously came the longest way. So I was quite grateful for that. So we started on the Wednesday. So it was Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, 4 days of challenges or competition, and then everyone left on Sunday.
And do you feel this pressure continually that you're just being watched?
To be quite honest, I didn't really feel that much pressure. It felt like a big training camp to me. I actually wished it was longer. It was too short for me. But I must say that maybe in the last day or two, I started feeling or realizing that, oh, shucks, they're probably watching us very closely, because the announcement is coming soon. Maddie, do you realize tomorrow they announce the winner? Maybe this dream comes to a crashing halt. You go home very disappointed, or ... But no, I think, obviously, I suppose it depends from person to person. I'm not sure how stressed my other two finalists were. I mean, we're friends. And funny enough, we were sharing a room as well. So I suppose that kind of makes it a little bit more tense. But I don't know, it felt like a big training camp to me, and like we were already part of the team. So to me, I enjoyed it so much.
To what extent had you been briefed before you left about what was going to be required of you? So, and by that, I mean, those who've watched, and hopefully some people will now go and watch it, we know that, for instance, the last test was a 12-minute, effectively a hill climb, but it was a 12-minute max test, basically. You did a few others. There were a couple of sprints and so on. Had they told you to anticipate that, or do you just go in there with anything still on the table? And then sort of related, I did notice in the show that obviously you're all getting the sponsors' bicycles. Were you fitted for those? Did you have enough time to get accustomed to them? Because I know the difference between one bike and another is large enough that if I got a bike I was unhappy on, I would be pretty displeased.
Yeah, I mean, if you ride as many hours as we do on your bike, you immediately feel 1 millimeter difference wherever it is. It's like, it's crazy how your body reacts to that. But before we went, we had to send in the measurements and stuff about our bike, and we took our own cleats as well. So the shoes and everything were our own. And they did tell us to bring our own saddles, but we didn't end up using our own, which I don't know. I like the saddle on the bike. So, but I took the bike out for a test ride the day I arrived on 22nd of January, and I got a big fright in that I didn't know how to change the gears, because I'm on Jura Ace or Shimano Jura Ace, and this was Shimano, and I'm like, there's only two buttons, like how do you go from the big chain to the small chain ring? And I was pushing and like, nothing's happening, I don't understand. And I was this close to googling how to use this, then someone came and helped me, showed me how to do it. And then when I was riding, I'm like, is it just me that's very shaky, or is the bike not so comfortable? Like, I don't understand what feels so strange. But then the day after, I was like, oh, this bike is amazing. I like this bike. I think it just takes a little bit of getting used to. So the bike setup, in terms of that, if you needed something changed, you could ask the mechanic, but essentially they just took our measurements from what we sent them from our own bikes. And then what was the other question?
I just wanted to know if you went in there with an understanding of what was going to be required of you, or it's kind of dropped on you day by day.
It just kind of dropped on us day by day. Like for the first day, for the inside test, they did tell us the day before or the evening before what we were going to do. And then they told us like carb up the night before. Da, da, da. So we knew what was going to happen during that day. But afterwards, we didn't know what would happen in the afternoons in terms of interviews or with the coaches, with the teams. Like that was just, they would just say, oh, girls, can you please come downstairs? And then when we come downstairs, okay, boom, mic up, get ready, you're going to speak now. It's like, oh, damn. And then for most of the other, let's say challenges, they told us the morning of, or even like the last day, they just told us get ready for a long endurance ride with maybe some challenges in between, but they didn't tell us what. And then before we started the individual time trial challenge, we literally found out just then what we were going to do. So
you couldn't actually almost mentally prepare for these challenges. You were just kind of thrown in there, so I guess every challenge, it was just full gas and doing the best that you could, because there was this kind of weird thing where they would discuss how well the athlete rode a climb, for instance. They would say about your climbing that you looked relaxed and very nice on the climb, whereas you weren't necessarily the fastest, which I found kind of strange that they didn't necessarily choose the fastest rider on a particular climb. Was that, did I understand that right?
Yeah, so what they said, that I looked really smooth. I wasn't, if you looked at the other two, they were really rocking back and forth. And from my personal experience, that has to do probably with core strength. Because the stronger your core is, the less you're going to go rocking back and forth. And I mean, also with those movements, you're wasting energy. You could use that energy to produce more watts going forward instead of side to side or whatever. But I think the decision wasn't necessarily made on one challenge or one aspect alone. I think it was in general, looking at everything as a whole picture, who was more complete cyclist and who would fit into the team in that. Yeah, but I honestly also, they asked me before, did I know I was going to win? I'm like, seriously, it could have gone either way. I had no idea. Like, I thought I stood a good chance, but I didn't know.
So when they show that moment on the TV where they're announcing the winner, you don't know before that you're hearing that for the first time live.
Yeah. And then when Danny told me, we're sorry to tell you, my heart sank to my feet. I thought, oh my goodness, don't cry, don't cry, don't cry. You're going to be fine. We're going to be fine. And then it changed. I'm like, yo, that, because she really gave me a heart attack. Like, that was not fun.
So obviously, though, just on that, though, the way that have you watched it back?
Yeah.
Okay. You know, like the way they film that is they film it one by one, but then they cut back and forth. So they didn't show only you, then only this. They show a little bit from you, a little bit from the other one. Did they lock you up in sort of a confined space so that you couldn't?
we were separate. It was after lunch. And then they told us they were going to separate us into different rooms. And then we're going to come out one by one to speak with the coaches, where the coaches are going to tell us their decisions. But I didn't know I was the last, like I was the last to come out. I did.
Well,
not
that's
know
what
this.
I was going to say, because they would have to do it like that in case.
Yeah.
In case the second placer comes out after the winner and sees them, then the suspense is lost.
Well, I didn't see Laura or Katie before I spoke to the coaches. Like, I assumed they were kept to the side.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things, I mean, there's one big question for me is that if you look at what they do around the academy, and because you've got the experience of having worked, I've been at the cycling academy and the global one. But if you look at what they did there, do you feel, having won that now, that you are well equipped now to potentially kick on with this professional contract?
I think the fact that they put their trust in me gives me the trust in myself to continue this journey and continue my development. And I have an amazing coach at the moment, which I started working with at the end of October last year, and he is working under the guidance of Elise Shabby's coach as well, who's on the world tour team of this team. So I think from what I've experienced at the finals week, I mean, or the 4 days we were there, it feels like the whole setup just feels like a one big family. And I mean, a happy athlete is a fast athlete. So if you feel you're supported and they trust you and they want to help you grow, then you will run through doors for them. So I feel like this is the setup I'm going to compared to where I was.
And what do you think it's going to take for you to then become a world tour rider from where you are now?
And specifically, sorry to add to that, have they made that clear to you, or are they saying let's go month by month or season by season, or is there like actually a set of standards that you already know you're working towards? If we see the following from you, you will stay on.
Your guess is as good as mine, I suppose. We haven't had that discussion yet, but I assume in the coming weeks that will be looked at. But I think I just need, I would say, obviously I've had a lot of experience, but I need more experience to improve on the things that I need to work on. And with the guidance from this team and the support structure, I think I know I can do it. I mean, one of my big goals ultimately is to wear the polka dot jersey in the Tour de France Avec Zwift, Femme Avec Zwift.
Yes, you actually mentioned that in the show, don't you?
Yeah. And I mean, how awesome is it that now I'm on the development team of the World Tour team that won that last year? I mean, who better to learn from? So,
So that show was recorded in October, November, was it?
January.
January. Yeah, they held it last. Yeah, it was a bit later this year. So the finals week was actually I arrived 22 January on my birthday. And it started on that week Wednesday. So I arrived on the Monday. And then on the 29th of January, I was already back in Joburg getting ready for nationals on the 4th of Feb.
And so, okay, so what I was going to ask, but I suppose now there's even less time frame for it, is have you seen and experienced much in the way of a change in your approach now that you're part of this team? You've spoken about having a coach already. I wonder whether you could talk whether the way your training has already started to evolve, the nutrition, some of the other things you might be doing in your own time. Is that any different now, or have you just tried to keep things the way they were, like a don't fix it if it ain't broke thing, and then wait for the meat of the season before you start making changes?
Well, I wouldn't say a lot has changed, but some things from training, like more recently, these last past weeks, me and my coach, we've more been focusing on efforts after I've already spent about 2,000 calories working on that. So doing max efforts after, 2.5-3 hours riding. Mm-hmm. So that has changed a bit. I didn't do that before. But other than that,
stuff.
Yeah. Mm. But other than that, I don't know. My training has changed since I started working with this coach, because before I went to the World Cycling Center, I'm an athlete that does a lot of hours on the bike and a lot of zone two stuff, and that works for me. But when I went to the center, the coaches there didn't feel like that was what I was supposed to do. So my training changed. And whilst I still had good numbers, I take my confidence from my training, and my confidence level dropped a bit because I didn't necessarily trust my training. And now working with this new coach, we've compared or analyzed what I did before the center and what I did during the center, what worked, what didn't work. And we found like a middle ground in terms of my training and how best to approach. While some might look at my training and think, holy moly, this girl is crazy. She's doing way too much. For me,
what are we talking, like 20 to 24 hours a week kind of stuff?
Well, in December, I was doing up to like 28, 29, 30 hours. Now, at the moment, it's around 20 to 25, 26 in that range, depending on the intensities and stuff. But what we've really tried to do is the keep the easy and the hard really hard. So there's not really a lot of in the middle stuff. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, that's kind of the trend. It worked. Yeah.
But it works for me. Yeah, it works for me. So, I mean, my numbers have improved and stuff. So.
That's the polarized training. Speaking of numbers, can I ask you, when you did the inside test at Zwift, did you have a power meter on the bike?
Yeah.
So you could actually see, and were you, so then there's a dilemma now that you've got, right? Is, do I trust what I know I can do, or do I try and find 5% more than I used to do? What was your approach to that? Like, you, because the inside test, for those who didn't listen, those who didn't watch it, was, correct me if I'm wrong, it's a 1, a 3, a 6, and a 12, right?
It's a 20-second, 3, 6, and 12, yeah.
20, 3, 6,
but,
and 12.
But, all, but it's not important to say that it's all from a seated position. We were not allowed to get off the saddle, which was really strange.
Yeah, I was going to say, why did they say that?
Someone brought that up on Discourse, actually. Maddie, Discourse is our for the podcast, has a chat forum. We'll give you access, actually, for giving us your time. Absolutely. And someone asked that very question discussing the show. And it's because normally when you test the stuff in a lab, the validity of the indoor trainer is affected a little bit when you get out of the saddle, because you unweight the rear wheel or the bike and so on. I watched it as well, and I don't think it would make much of a – it certainly wouldn't make a material difference to the field testing, which was different this year, because last year in the Zwift Academy,
they did it inside.
They did all the inside tests on the indoor. So I was actually quite pleased to see them doing it outdoor this year. I think it gives it a great validity.
I'm thankful we didn't do it inside, because, no. I feel like, in general, my numbers inside and outside, there's a difference. And not a good difference.
Not
are they
you.
Better outside then?
Yeah, or at least in my experience, my numbers are better outside.
So back to the numbers then. So what was your strategy? Was it to say, right, I know that I'm capable of, and I'm doing, I watched this a few weeks back, so my memory might be hazy, but it was like mid sevens for the 3 minutes, or I think you did 5.14 for the last 12-minute trial. So when you say that, okay, are you gonna say, what, that's pretty close to my ceiling, I'm gonna try for 5.3. Well, you're going to say, I'm going to go 5 and see if I can pick it up at the end. What was your strategy around pacing yourself?
Yeah, so I had this discussion with my coach the evening before. I had certain number, like we looked at my numbers for the last, what, let's say 3 months. So I went into each test with the kind of an idea of the number that I wanted to hit. And if I hit over it, great. But
yeah.
As long as I could hit that, I'd be happy. And for all of them, I exceeded it a little bit. So I was quite happy with that. Although I personally feel I could have done better on the 3 minutes. Was I allowed to stand? Because normally for those types of efforts, I would do it out of the saddle the entire way. That's just how I do it. But no, I was happy with my numbers and all of them. And in general, the leading up to the Zwift Academy, obviously my focus was more on nationals. The Zwift Academy was just a bonus. And my coach was like, the training we're doing for nationals anyway will help for the Zwift Academy, so it's fine. But we were more focusing or working on the, let's say, 1 to 3 minute, 4 or 5 minute efforts rather than the 12 minutes or the 10 minutes or whatever. So I didn't expect too much going into that one because I haven't really worked on it. I mean, I'm in Bloemfontein. Where am I going to find a 12-minute hill? It's like, it's not going to work.
It's going to drop it down to the bottom chain ring and go into a wind.
You find a headwind and pretend you're going uphill.
Yeah. The wind is our hill training. Yeah, fair enough. But
So, just because we got a lot of listeners who love the numbers. The 3-minute power was what? Do you remember? Can you tell us?
If I remember correctly, it was 3:56. 356.
So that's 7 watts a kilo?
Yeah, I'm about just maybe under 7. I'm about 56 kgs.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Because that's quite a high-stakes pacing decision you're making there, right? Because you know, if you go 3 minutes hard and you stuff it up and you go the first
you're going to blow up.
Like, that's going to be a disaster. And then think you do that at the Zwift Academy. So that's why I ask. It's really interesting to know, like, the mindset. Because the stakes are so high, you want this thing so bad. The temptation to go 5% too hard must be so enormous.
Well, I was aiming for 3:30, to be honest. Yeah. So that was where I was keeping it in the first, I think, minute. But then essentially I was ramping it up.
And they must see that, right? Because now if I'm a coach and I see that, I see a 356 that's made up of a 330, a 350, and a 370. That means something different to a 350 for 3 minutes. You know what I mean? Well, so even the number has nuance in it. I would value that more than a solid 350.
Well, my 12-minute was a lot. Like, I think I was aiming for around 272. Well, I think I started around 260, 270. That was the aim. But then it gradually went up, and I ended on, I think, 295 or something like this. So my approach was more, I'd rather play it safe than risk blowing up and then completely tossing everything out of the cut.
Have you had the opportunity to train yet with the caliber of cyclists that you'll now be competing against?
I've not really, like, at the center, there were some riders that came for training camps, like Tennille Campbell. She races for Jayco Alula. She was at the center a couple of years ago, also on the team, so ridden with her a couple of times. But other than that, I've only raced against these big names. I've not actually trained with them. So it was quite intimidating when they put us, like, in those sprints against these World Tour riders. I'm like, shit, no, I'm sprinting against Kashia.
Oh, I was just going to say, you got the World Tour rider from that team. Eh? Kashia
was your... I made a complete shit show out of that sprint. It's like...
What did you hit in that sprint? What sort of wattage did you get? Did you get 700, 800?
It was around, it was in between 700 and 800. Like, I don't generally go to 800. I'm not a sprinter. Like, my max is 700.
Because I must say, it was noticeable. Do you remember the sprints? Every single, in the men and the women, they just get absolutely bombed off.
Because that seems to be the difference. The difference between the world tour pros is that the sprinting is where they just seem to show that ability, you know?
Yeah.
Well, that was
kind of, those are from climbers.
I mean, Cassia and people like Matteo van der Poel, obviously are the best in the world at that. So
yeah, they're shifting.
You're not competing against your average world tour pro. You're competing against the very best.
I must say that, though, if you have me do that a couple of times, I have a really good, my repeatability in efforts is really good. So if I had to do 700 watts a couple of times, I could do that. But going over that peak top end sprint, that's not going to happen, but I can do it a couple of times.
Yeah, I suppose that's a skill in itself, isn't it? I mean, one of the questions I'd ask if I was in your position is that, well, look at my numbers and they look at the results of the stuff that you did in that week and, you know, all the other stuff you've done over the years. Can you look at your numbers and say, I physically, in terms of numbers, am at a world tour level? In other words, is that the one area where you feel that physically you're there? It's just the skills and the other thing that you need to learn.
I know my numbers are there. It's not to sound cocky or anything, because trust me, I am not cocky. I am someone who needs to work on her confidence, but I know my numbers are at the very top. I've been told my numbers are world tour level. It's just learning the racing skills to actually implement and use the numbers that I have that I'm still working on.
Yeah. Because it's interesting. I mean, you get a lot of criticism. The critics of the machines and the devices that you can use now will say, well, cycling's become boring because people just look at their devices on their bikes and they ride to their watts. But as you've explained in many different occasions, this cycling is way more than just numbers, isn't it?
Yeah, well, in racing, I have it on your bike computer. You can change like the things that you see on the screen. And during races, I don't have my power on there. Like, I don't even look at it because I get too much in my head about the numbers. So if I have an off day and I can't hit the numbers that I usually do, I'd be like, what the hell's going on with you, Maddie? It's like, wake up. What's wrong? You're stronger than this. But on the other days, also, if I feel really good and I go over my numbers, then I might start freaking out. Maybe I'm doing too much. Maybe I'm going to 1, 2, 3, pop goes the weasel. It's like one of those catch-22s. So in racing, I don't look at my numbers. All I have is the race map or the GPX and the time or duration of the race so that I know when do I need to take my nutrition. But
so you're not looking at heart rate either. You just basically
I'm gonna totally freak out if I see heart rate 190. It's like, damn, and there's still 5Ks of this climb left. I'm gonna die. No.
it's a good tip. I remember James Kunema, the great South African triathlete, used to do that, where he would run the marathon without a watch at all because he felt that he had to do everything on feel. So it's interesting that seems to be quite a common thing.
There's two types of athletes. There's Maddie.
Yeah.
And then there are people who need the numbers to reassure themselves.
Yeah. I'm definitely more in the Maddie camp, I think.
Because like then you get people who say like, this sucks, this hurts, but hang on, let me check. Oh, it's 260 watts. I know I can do this. It's not that bad. I'm okay. I can find some confidence. I can go back into the training diary and I can reassure myself that I've actually got the capability of producing these numbers. But you can see that's the sort of person who's very vulnerable, because now when it's 280, or if they feel really bad,
they're going to freak out, imploding,
you know. But so you got to know yourself.
If you're racing, you're always going to go harder than you ever would in training.
Yes, so numbers exactly.
Mean nothing in racing,
and,
don't you?
I mean, and also in racing, it'd be wrong to be focused on your computer the whole time. You have to look around you, know what's going on in the race, follow the wheels. You're not gonna, someone's attacking and they're going what at 700 watts and they go past you and you're looking down at your computer, oh, 300 watts, no, damn, this is over my limit, I can't follow that. It's like, that's not what racing is.
Although, again, we've seen in the men's tour, some teams won races by the numbers, huh?
Yeah, for sure.
That's why they used to ride, looking at the stem, and they.
Yeah.
And so there are different ways that you can.
Even the Chris Froomes still had to have some pretty good racecraft just to be in a position where they could be like that on the pumps, as Maddie has said. You know, it isn't just about the numbers at the end of the day.
Well,
what are the questions I wanted to ask? Carry on, Maddie.
I could give you an example. There was one race that I was planning on putting on the numbers. I was supposed to go to Africa Games, that's now in Ghana at the moment, but some family reasons I decided to withdraw. But the course didn't necessarily suit me. It's completely flat and I'm a climber. Although I know I come from Bloemfontein, I'm still a climber. That doesn't mean anything. My plan was to like go, okay, for this singular specific race, I will put the watts on so that I can see what I do. So my plan was to go 30-30s on them the whole time, because I know I've been doing this a lot in training. So I would go like, okay, 400 watts, 30 seconds, come down. 30 seconds, 15 seconds or whatever. Okay. All the time until the elastic snapped and they let me go. So that was my plan. So in terms of, there are certain cases where watts in races can be useful, but yeah.
Oh, that's also good, isn't it? That's good advice. I can imagine that would work, and you just race to the end there.
I'm going to do that to Mike tomorrow morning on the way to stay. I'm going to drop 30-30s on my mates.
Just a final question. What are the things that they did on the men's side? I saw them doing a lot of these. Was it lactate tests where they were taking blood from the ear?
You know, finger prick on the finger prick, ear prick.
Did they do that kind of stuff with you guys as well?
No.
Okay. You weren't just being stuck with the needles and becoming mini lab rats. Because it looked like on the men's side, they were like little lab rats, weren't they? To some extent.
Yeah.
I'm guessing you will. You either have or you will do it in the future, though, right? Because it's kind of like the done thing.
Yeah, I haven't before, but my coach really wants me to do a lactate test. So I'm sure that will, in the foreseeable future, that will be on my schedule very soon.
Marcel Guarini was doing them here in Stellenbosch. His coach came out specifically for a week, and it's the first thing they did. And the men, they do it. And it's pretty widely done now, because they want to try and measure where you start to accumulate lactate, so they can work out what that training zone is just below that.
Yeah, so you can specifically effort, look at the zones.
You would typically do like an 8 to 10 minute effort, like up a steady climb, so that you've got a steady state hard effort for that duration at a different power outputs, and then you'd measure it. And interestingly enough, in the men's Zwift Academy, the test failed because they didn't give them a hard enough workloads. They weren't measuring any lactate, and they wasted the day. They got no results from it.
You don't see the men at all. I mean, it's a separate camp altogether, isn't it?
Well, they were there the week before us, so they already left when we started. But in previous years, the men and women were... The camps work together.
That's right. Yeah, not this year. Yeah.
Is your predecessor Zwift Academy winner? I think it was Alex. Is that right? Is she still there with the team?
Yeah, yeah. She's Alex Maurice. Yeah, she's still there.
Yeah.
Okay. She has reached out, and I suppose I can say all of the previous Zwift Academy winners from the woman's side have reached out to congratulate me. And yeah, I will hopefully meet Alex very soon.
Very good.
How long is your contract then that you've essentially won?
I'm not quite sure yet. This is the nitty gritty things that they've not really spoken to me about yet. So I hope I find out soon.
So I'm guessing, because what I was going to ask is, have you got a sense of what your calendar looks like? Like, when are you going back over to Europe? When do you join up to the team? And have you got any races on the schedule yet?
Well, I know for the next 2 months, the races, if I'll be doing them all, that's another question. They tell me it depends on selection. But I arrive next week, Tuesday, in Europe. And then the first race is a Spanish Cup race next weekend. So I'm not sure if I will race that. I kind of like, on the one hand, maybe it's not such a good idea to, it's a new team. I've not raced with these teammates before, new equipment and that. But on the other hand, good to get out the cobwebs, because it's not a UCI 1.1. It's just a Spanish Cup. Well, I say just, the level is still high, but it's not like there's UCI points. And then, But the first real race that I'm kind of sure that I will race would be GP Chambéry on the 14th of April in France. And I've done this race 2 times now already the last 2 years, so kind of know what to expect. And I think it's a course that suits me, so I'm quite excited for that one.
Okay.
Well, we'll certainly be watching with a great deal of interest with your progress. I know we're obviously biased here in South Africa because we are a South African podcast, but we're very proud of what you've achieved there. And I'm sure that you're certainly, from what you've told us, you know, your ability to be able to say, well, you're very determined, you know, people telling you that you're not capable of doing something, you seem to come back even stronger. So you've certainly got that determination, and hopefully we'll see you in the polka dot jersey at the Tour de France Avec Swift. In the next couple of years. That's the plan.
This sounds really, really stupid when I say it like this, but this whole Zwift Academy thing is the proper middle finger I need. What do you know?
Exactly. I think we'll just leave it there, Maddie. Thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Science of Sport podcast. Follow us on X, Facebook, Instagram, and join the conversation on our exclusive Science of Sport Patreon page.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.